Hey, good morning, everyone. I want to welcome everyone to the conference. We're going to be hearing from Rabbi Meir Finkelstein, who's in the Wexner Kol Elyon. He's also a master student at Revel. He's the rabbinic associate at the Young Gazelle of West Hempstead and serves as the Rosh Kol El in the Shul Summer Kol El. He received smicha from Reitz, holds a degree in psychology from Yeshiva University. Prior to that, he studied in Keren Biavne, and in yeshiva, he's had the privilege of spending 6 years studying under Rav Shechter and 3 summers under Rav Willig. The topic he's going to be discussing is the methodology and the unique status of Pirush Rashi al Torah, and you get a picture of Rashi also, so it's very exciting.
Thank you, Rabbi Steinmetz. Good morning. I want to begin just by acknowledging the presence of my parents who are here, and of course acknowledging Rebbe's presence. It is very humbling to be speaking in the shir room that I spent many years learning from Rebbe. So I will begin just by asking Rebbe's rishus, and we'll begin the shir. Our topic for today is the methodology and unique status of Pirush Rashi al Torah. Rashi's Perush is something that all of us are familiar with. We grow up learning Rashi, we learn Chumash with Rashi from a very young age. And today I want to explore one unique question within Rashi's Perush, and that is that one major facet of Rashi's Perush, Rashi's commentary, is that Rashi extensively quotes Midrashim in his Perush al Torah. Anyone who has learned Rashi is familiar with the fact that Rashi quotes Midrashim very frequently, word for word, sometimes with slight alterations. 70% of Rashi's Perush is from Divrei Chazal, from either Midrashim or from Gemara. 70% is quoting Divrei Chazal. So the question is, a fundamental question when we learn Rashi that we need to ask ourselves is, what's the difference between learning Rashi and opening up a Medrash Rabbah and learning up the Medrash? What's the difference if I have a pasuk that I want to understand, and I could look at the way the Gemara interprets that pasuk, I could look at the way the Medrash Rabbah or the Medrash Tanchuma interprets that pasuk. What's the difference between opening up Rashi and seeing what Rashi does as opposed to just reading the Medrash itself? In other words, what was Rashi accomplishing when he wrote his Perush that Chazal had not already done and formulated for us? So the interesting thing is, when it comes to Perush Rashi, Rashi left us in the dark a little bit about what he did, because most Mefarshim on the Torah wrote Hakdamas. Ibn Ezra wrote a Hakdamah to his Perush al Torah. The Ramban wrote a Hakdamah to his Perush al Torah. Rashi never wrote a Hakdamah. And because of that, we don't actually know exactly what Rashi was trying to accomplish, because he never told us. And because of that, that left jobs for many, many Talmidei Chachamim in the years after Rashi wrote his Perush to try to piece back together, based on other comments of Rashi scattered in different places, what Rashi's derech is and what Rashi was trying to accomplish. One of the primary comments that is pointed to is a Rashi in Bereishis Perek Gimel Pasuk Ches, where Rashi writes, if you take a look at the bottom of the slide, Yesh Midrashei Agada Rabim. There are many Midrashei Agada on the Pasuk. Ukvar Sidrum Rabbeinu Rabosinu Al Machonam Bereishis Rabba Uvishar Midrashos. And Chazal already organized them in Bereishis Rabba and the other collections of Medrash, acknowledging really the question we've begun with, that Divrei Chazal are already organized in the Midrashim. And now Rashi says, but where's my unique contribution? What am I, Rashi, coming to accomplish? Va'ani, and I, Rashi, lo basi ela lipshuto shel mikra, ula agada hamiyasheves divrei hamikra davar davur alofanav. I, Rashi, come only to explain A, pshuto shel mikra, the pshat of the psukim, and B, agada, the medrash, but a very specific type of agada. The agada that's miyasheves divrei hamikra davar davur alofanav, the midrashim that fit in with the text, the words, the sequence of the psukim. And here we get our first clue, and our best clue in all of Pirush Rashi, as to what Rashi's trying to accomplish, what Rashi's doing differently than the medrash already did. Rashi quotes a very select type of medrash. Rashi doesn't quote medrash indiscriminately. Rashi quotes only midrashim which fit the text, which fit the words and the sequence of the psukim of Tanakh. And while this helps us to open the door to try to understand what Rashi was doing, it really begs another question, because if that's the case, So now we really just have to bump up the question and ask, why did Rashi do that? Right? If Chazal in their Midrashim, Chazal many, many types of Midrashim, and if you look in the Gemara and the Medrash Rab, and there's an array of Midrashim. And Rashi here already makes us sensitive to the fact that there are some Midrashim that fit the words, and some Midrashim which seem to fit the text less. And Rashi will only quote the former and not the latter. The question is, why did Rashi do that? If Chazal thought all the Midrashim were critical and indispensable, so why did Rashi only give us a select portion of Midrashim, only those which fit the text? So I want to share with you two different interpretations, two different approaches as to how to answer this question. There are two general approaches as how to approach Pirush Rashi, and we're going to see approach number one through the eyes of Nechama Leibowitz. Nechama Leibowitz was not the first one to say the approach that we're going to explain, but she formulated it very well and very comprehensively. And so we're going to use her words to quote to explain this approach. Nechama Leibowitz, in one essay quoted at the bottom here, which deals with this topic comprehensively, but also in many of her writings. So she draws upon the Mefarshei Rashi, those who wrote commentaries on Perush Rashi, like Mizrahi, like Gur Aryeh, like Maskil Adavid, the different Perushim on Rashi, who tried to figure out what Rashi is doing on any given pasuk. And Nechama Leibowitz advanced a thesis that it can be shown through Rashi's citation and selection of Midrashim throughout his Torah commentary, invariably serves to explain the text, those are the key words, and not to adorn the words of the Torah with the rabbinic pearls. In other words, according to Nechama Leibowitz, every single Medrash that Rashi quotes is for the purpose of explaining the text, or as she formulates further in a part that's not here on the quote, to explain Pshuto Shel Mikra. Nechama Leibowitz explains, and again, it's not her Chiddush, but based on the Mefarshei Rashi, the Rishonim, which came before her. So she shows how Rashi will only ever quote a Medrash when there's something in the text of the Chumash or in the Tanakh which prompted him to do so. When there's a problem with reading the pasuk, there's something that doesn't fit, there's something that needs resolution, and the pshat just can't read straight, I need to quote a Medrash in order to resolve the problem in the pshat. Nechama Leibowitz demonstrates, interestingly, that the Mefarshei Rashi approach two different types of Midrashim in different ways when dealing with this question. There's one type of Medrash which Rashi often invokes in his Perush Al Torah, the Medrash which deals with the question of Smichos Parshios. You often have a question in Rashi, Lama Nismicha Parsha Zu Lazu, Lama Nismicha Miraglim Lamiriam, etc., etc. Different types of Parshios. Why is this Parsha juxtaposed to the other Parsha? So Nechama Leibowitz notes the following comment of the Mizrahi on one such case of Smichos Parshios that we find in Rashi. And she cites this comment of the Mizrahi to support her thesis that Rashi always only ever quotes a Medrash when the Pshat demands it. This Rashi is talking about why the Parsha of Amalek is next to the Parsha of Masa Umariva. The Parsha of Masa Umariva, where Klal Yisrael complained for water, and Hashem gives them water. And then right after that we read, Vayavo Amalek, Vayilachem im Yisrael Birfidim. Right after that we read the Parsha of Amalek. And Rashi wonders, Samach Parsha Zulamikra Zeh, why do we have Amalek right next to Masa Umariva? And Rashi goes on to explain that the reason is because Hashem was telling Klal Yisrael, you know, I just took you out of Mitzrayim, I just showed you Eser Makos, I just showed you Kriyas Yamsuf, I showed you Gila Eshchina. And then you come to Masa Umariva and you wonder, Hayesh Hashem Bekebenu Imayin. You come to Masa Umariva and you're wondering, is Hashem really there? So Hashem, Rashi says, Hashem got angry at Klal Yisrael and he says, I'm going to make you call out for me. I'm going to make you call out and recognize that I'm there. That's why Amalek came and attacked. And it demanded Klal Yisrael to turn to Hashem. Rashi explains that's why these two parashios are next to each other. That's what Amalek has to do with Masa Umariva. But take a look at this remarkable comment of the Mizrahi. The Mizrahi writes on what Rashi says, Vayavo Amalek, Samach Parashios Ulamikrazeh V'chuleh, the top is Rashi, we're going to read the bottom. Be'ela Shemos Rabba, the Mizrahi says, the source for this Medrash that Rashi quotes, so this is the Medrash interprets, this is the Midrashic interpretation of why we have this Smichos Parashios. The source is in Shemos Rabba. And says the Mizrahi, Drasha Ba'almahu. The Mizrahi says, this is a Drasha Ba'almah. What does a drasha ba'alma mean? So Mizrahi explains what it means. He says, Ki behechreyach haya, שתסמך פרשה זו למקרה זה, מאחר ששני המעשים היו ברפידו. Mizrahi says, the Medrash did not mean that this is the interpretation of the Psukim. Because, what's the reason that the Parsha of Amalek is right next to the Parsha of Maaseh Meriva? Because chronologically, that's how they happened. So one was right next to the other. They should be next to each other. They happened geographically in the same location. So Mizrahi says, that's why they're next to each other. Why did Chazal say that they're next to each other for another reason? Chazal wanted to teach us a critical, important lesson, not meaning to say that this is the reason that the two parashios are together. It was Chazal's way of conveying an extremely important Musar Haskel, an extremely important message, but not that this was the reason Chazal said it, that these needed to be, this needed to be the interpretation of the Psukim. But then Mizrahi says, Aval hatima me Rashi zal. He says, that's okay for the Medrash to do. The Medrash can sometimes teach us a Musar Haskel, even if it's not technically the Pshat of the Psukim. But Rashi can't do that. Aval hatema me Rashi zal, shehiniach kol masha darshu b'smichos kol ha-Torah kula, v'lo hevi b'peirushav rak ha-smichos she'ein sham mekomo bovad, shehu karov l'pshuto shal mikra, upo hevi ha-medrash shal zeh ha-smichos shehu b'hakreyach, Mizrahi says, I don't understand Rashi. Because there are many times where Chazal will darshan a smichos. There are times where Chazal will have an explanation of why two parashios are next to each other, and Rashi won't quote that medrash because it's distant from the pshat of the psukim. Because Rashi will say there's no need to quote that medrash. There's nothing in the pshat that's inconsistent that demands me quoting that medrash. So it's okay for the medrash to do that, but that's, as we saw at the beginning, it's not Rashi's goal. Rashi only quotes Agada HaMiyashev as Divrei HaMikra. So Mizrahi's bewildered, why then did Rashi quote this Medrash? This Medrash seems to not be needed to explain the Psukim. The Psukim are read well on their own. And the Mizrahi throws up his hands, he doesn't have an answer. But Nachama Leibowitz points out, from the assumption of the Mizrahi, what you see is the Mizrahi cannot fathom a possibility of Rashi quoting a Medrash unless there was a demand in the Psukim, something wrong with the Pshat, that required Rashi to bring such a Medrash. That's when it comes to a Medrash like Smichos Parshios, where Nachama Leibowitz notes that of all the Mefarshei Rashi, there are many Mefarshei Rashi, all Mefarshei Rashi in her assessment uniformly agree, that when it comes to this type of Medrash, Rashi will only ever quote a medrash when it's needed to explain the pshat. When it comes to other types of medrashim, though not smichos parshios, so Nachama Leibowitz observes that here the Mefarshei Rashi actually are split. Some think that this is the goal of Rashi, others ascribe a different goal to Rashi. What that different goal is, we'll have to wait until we explain the second approach to see Rashi, until we understand where those fit in. Nachama Leibowitz argues the thrust of her essay, and really the thrust of many of her writings in general, where she explains Parshanut and Divrei Rashi, is to adopt and argue the first side, and that is Rashi will only ever quote a Medrash if it's needed in order to explain the Pshat. Just to see two quick examples of this idea, to see two quick examples of where Rashi invokes a Medrash, where the Pshat cannot be understood. There's something lacking in the Pshat. There's something, if we didn't have Rashi, if we didn't have Chazal, we wouldn't be able to piece together the words of the Psukim. And so Rashi invokes a Medrash in order to explain the Pshat. Example number one, we'll see two examples from the same episode in Tanakh, in Parshas Vayetze, where Yaakov meets Lavan, and Yaakov works in order to marry Rachel. The Pasuk says, Vayehav Yaakov es Rachel. Yaakov loved Rachel. Vayomer, and he says to Lavan, Evadcha sheva shanim, I will work for you for 7 years, Berachel bitcha ketana, for Rachel, your younger daughter. And now here there's an obvious inconsistency in the pasuk. There's something that begs interpretation, which is, we already know Rachel is the younger daughter. We already know Leah is the older daughter, Rachel is the younger daughter. So why does Yaakov here need to say, and why does the Torah need to record Yaakov saying, something we already know? The pasuk should just say, Vayehav Yaakov es Rachel, Vayomer evodcha sheva shanim b'Rachel. End of story. We also already know she's bitcha. So here Rashi quotes a medrash to answer that question. Again, the pshat cannot read. So to explain the pshat, Rashi writes, Kol ha-simanim halalu lama. Why did Yaakov give all these signs as to who he wanted to marry? Well, lefi she'odeya b'shu ramai, because he knows Lavan is a trickster. So Amar lo avodcha b'Rachel. So he says to Laban, I will serve you for Rachel. V'shema tomer Rachel acheres min hashuk. Maybe you'll say, well, I'll give you a different Rachel. So tamar lomer bitcha. That's why Yaakov needed to say bitcha, even though we already know that Rachel is Yaakov's daughter. V'shema tomer achlif l'leya shema v'ekra shema Rachel. And maybe you'll say, well, I'll change Rachel's name, Leah, Leah's name Rachel, and I'll call Leah Rachel, and I'll really give you Leah, who's now called Rachel. So Talmud Lomer Haketana. That's why Yaakov needed to say Haketana, even though we already know that Rachel is Haketana. And nevertheless, it didn't work because Lavan still was successful in tricking Yaakov. Example number one, where Rashi needs a medrash, he needs Divrei Chazal in order to explain the pshat of the psukim. Take another example in the very same episode. Vayomer lo Lavan. So Lavan says to Yaakov, Ach atzmi uvsari ata vayeshev imo chodesh yamim. Lavan says to Yaakov, you are my flesh and blood. We're family. So I'll let you stay with me. I'll let you live in my house. This is when Yaakov meets Lavan, and Lavan invites him in to live with him. So Rashi here quotes a medrash. Rashi says, Me'ata enli la'astacha habaisa, ho'el ve'en v'yadcha klum. What Lavan was really saying to Yaakov, although these words don't appear in the Pasuk, what Lavan really meant by these words, Lavan said, you're my family, you're my flesh and blood, so I'll let you come in. What he really meant by that was, I don't have any reason to accept you, because you're not offering me anything. You're not giving me any money, you're not paying me rent, you're not doing anything for me, so there's no reason I should let you into my house. But, because we're relatives, so I'll let you come and I'll put up with you for a little while. And that's exactly what Lavan did. But even this, Lavan did not do for free. It wasn't of the goodness of Lavan's own heart. Lavan did it because Yaakov was providing a service because he shepherded his sheep. So Rashi here does something interesting. Again, quoting a medrash, Rashi here inserts a whole dialogue that didn't happen in the psukim. The psukim don't tell us about this dialogue. Rashi puts it in. The question is, how does this relate to the Pasuk? The Pasuk didn't indicate anything about this. So Nechama Leibowitz explains that there actually is one word in the Pasuk which not only indicates this comment of Chazal, but proves it. There's one word in the Pasuk which can't be read at all without this medrash, and that is the word Ach. Had Lavan said to Yaakov, Vayomer lo Lavan, Atzmi uvsari ata vayeshev imo chodesh yamim, we would have had no problems and Rashi wouldn't have commented. But the word ach doesn't fit. Why does the word ach not fit? Because every other time in Kol Torah Kula, when you have the word ach, ach always comes in opposition to something. Not this, ach that. Ach always comes as opposed to something else, ach this. Well, here there's nothing to come as opposed to. Nothing was said before that Lavan is opposing. So why the word ach? Nechama Leibowitz explains that's what demanded Rashi to quote this medrash. Again, Rashi's method, Rashi's derech, of wanting to use Divrei Chazal to explain the pshat. So Rashi said, the only way I have explaining the word ach is to explain, no, there was something that Lavan was coming opposed to. As opposed to my normal practice of only inviting in people who can provide something for me, I'll make an exception for you, Yaakov, because you're Atzmi Uvsari. So, ach, although I wouldn't do this, ach, asmi uvsari ata, but because you are my flesh and blood, I'll let you into my house. These are two examples where we see very vividly of how Rashi uses medrash for the purpose of explaining pshat. What motivates Rashi to quote a medrash is when Rashi's bothered by something in the pshat and he needs the medrash to resolve that inconsistency. What's interesting, though, and this is where things become very fascinating, is that if this is correct, if what we're suggesting is correct, what Nechama Leibowitz is suggesting is correct, that this is Rashi's derech, so then what comes out is that Rashi had a very different approach to the words Pshuto Shel Mikra, to what it means to interpret the Torah on its pshat level, than the other Mefarshim did. There were other Mefarshim who also interpreted Chumash based on pshat. And it seems that they had a very different understanding of pshat then what this approach to Rashi would lead us to conclude. Take a look at the following comment of the Ibn Ezra. This is in the Ibn Ezra's introduction to his Sefer Safa Brura, which is a grammatical Sefer, a Sefer of Diktuk by the Ibn Ezra. And the Ibn Ezra here writes in a paragraph about his approach to the relationship between Pshat and Drash. And he writes, "Ve'atabni sim libcha, ki kadmonenu zichronam livracha ma'atike hamitzvah, pershu parshios gam psukim levadam, gam milos gam osios al derech drash, gam b'mishna gam b'talmud u'b'braisos." So Ibn Ezra says, Chazal interpreted all of Torah al derech drash, psukim, words, parshios. They explained the Medrash's understanding of the psukim of the Torah. And the Ibn Ezra was a parish who was very committed to explaining the pshat. And he writes, "Ve'in safek shehem yadu haderach hayashara ka'asher hi, alkein amru klal in mikra yote midei pshuto." But they also knew that there was a pshat interpretation of the Torah, which the Ibn Ezra takes to an extreme, much more so than the other Mefarshim do. The Ibn Ezra commits very strongly to pshat. And he says, Chazal already acknowledged that there is a pshat layer of interpretation in addition to the Medrash's layer of interpretation. And that's why they said, "Ein mikra yotze midei pshuto." A pasuk does not leave its pshat. The hadrash huto sefes tam. And the medrash is an additional layer of interpretation, but it's not the pshat of the psukim. And look what the Ibn Ezra says next. The Ibn Ezra invites into the conversation the topic of our shir. "V'hadoros habayim samu kol drash ikar v'shoresh." He says the earlier generations focused exclusively on the medrash. Like who? Kerev Shlomo zichronim lebracha, like Rashi. Shapirish hatoru neviim uksuvim al derech drash. Like Rashi, who explained based on medrash. V'hu ko shev ki hu al derech pshat. Rashi thinks he's telling you the pshat. V'ein besparov pshat rek echon mini aleph. Not one in a thousand of Rashi's comments are the pshat. They're really all the medrash. How can Ibn Ezra say such a thing? Didn't we just develop that Rashi is about pshat? Rashi quotes medrash to explain pshat. Rashi quotes medrash when there's an inconsistency in the pshat. So the Ibn Ezra already gave away the answer in the first part of the paragraph. The Ibn Ezra told us, well, there's this dichotomy. There's drash and pshat, and they're two separate realms, and they're two different ways. They're two different layers of interpretation, two different ways, two different levels of interpreting the Chumash. So if one is working in medrash, he's not going to use pshat. And if one is using in pshat, working in pshat, he's not going to use medrash. According to Ibn Ezra, you interpret pshat based on pshat alone. You interpret pshat based on diktuk considerations, based on syntax considerations, based on considerations of context. But you're not going to look to the medrash to bring in pshat. Medrash is an entirely different layer of interpretation. And this way of thinking is formulated very well. If the Ibn Ezra didn't agree with this particular statement, he would have agreed with some broad variation of this statement. The statement of the Mahari Kara, who was a Perush on Nach from Rashi's Beis Medrash. And the Mahari Kara is known as a Pshat Perush. What's interesting is that once Rashi wrote his Perush al Torah, the Talmidei Chachamim who came subsequently from Rashi's Beis Medrash focused even more on pshat than Rashi himself did. Whether Rashi is about pshat or not, which we still have a few minutes to try to develop, his Talmidim were very committed to pshat. The Rashbam, for instance, in his Perush al Torah, very committed to pshat. The Mahari Kara as well, another member of Rashi's Beis Medrash, was very committed to pshat. And in one of his comments on Sefer Shmuel, the Mahari Kara tells you how he approaches interpreting pshat. And he writes, "Ach da'alecha, you should know, kishenichtiva ha'nevua, when a nevua is written, when a nevua is recorded in Tanakh, shleima nichtiva im pisrona v'kol ha'tzorech. It is recorded in its entirety, and every single thing you need in order to understand the nevua is there in the words of the Tanakh. Ve'ein tzorech lahavi raya mimakom acher. You don't need to bring proof from somewhere else. V'lo medrash, and you don't need to bring a raya from the medrash. Ki Torah temima nitna, utmima nichtava velo techsar kolba. Because the Torah, the text of the Torah, is complete and is self-sufficient. And to interpret the pshat, all one needs to do is look internally in the text of the Torah, the Navi, as it is in this instance, and be able to figure out the pshat of the psukim. U'medrash chachaminu kidei lahagdil Torah v'yadir. The medrash is an additional level of interpretation. But it's not the pshat. So the Mahari Kara, very similar to what we saw with Ibn Ezra, approaches pshat as a different discipline than medrash. There's the midrashic level of interpretation, there's the pshat level of interpretation. If what we're suggesting in this approach to Rashi is correct, it comes out Rashi had a whole different way of approaching pshuto shel mikra. for Rashi, it wasn't such a stark dichotomy. You have Medrash, you have Pshat, and they belong to two different worlds and they don't overlap at all. For Rashi, the way of reading the Pshat very often is with the Medrash. For Rashi, I cannot understand the Pshat without the Medrash. There are words in the Pshat that are inconsistent. There are phrases in the Pshat which are inconsistent and cannot be pieced together unless I can turn to the Medrash. If we adopt approach number one to Rashi, it comes out a very different type of Pshuto Shel Mikra than the other Pshat Mefarshim seem to have adopted. But not everybody took this approach to Perush Rashi. We're going to see in a second that there are problems with assuming that this is what Rashi was all about. To assume, to say that Rashi only ever quotes a Medrash when there's a problem with the Pshat, is going to lead us into some very tough spots in Perush Rashi. Before I show you, though, before we take a look at those comments of Rashi, I want to just introduce this second approach with a comment of Rav Yehuda Cooperman. Rav Yehuda Cooperman, who is known for having really developed the world of Limud Tanakh and Limud Pshuto Shel Mikra Al Taras HaKodesh. He's famous for his footnotes on the Meshech Chachma, his footnotes on the Tziv and the Sfarno, and his masterful work Al Mekomo Shel Pshuto Shel Mikra, about the role of Pshat within the Mesorah of Chazal and within our Mesorah of Torah Shebaal Peh. And he was also the founder of the Mechalah Seminary in Yerushalayim. So Rabbi Cooperman writes in his Sefer, Mekubal lomar shematoras Rashi b'perusho la Torah haisa lelamedas hamikra al pi pshuto shel mikra o al pi ma'amare Chazal shenitan liyashvam al pi pshuto shel mikra. Rav Cooperman says that it is accepted to say that Rashi's goal in his Perush Al HaTorah was to teach the Mikra, to teach the Psukim, according to the Pshat, or according to Ma'amari Chazal, that can be explained why they're needed, that can be resolved based on Pshat considerations. Whose approach is this? Approach number one. This is Nechama Leibowitz's approach. And this is the standard approach, Mekubal Lomar. This is Rashi's approach, that Rashi will quote, explain the Pshat, or a Medrash which is needed by the Pshat. But Lanu Nireh, he says, it appears to us, Ki Hagdara Zos, this definition of Rashi's goal, HaMekubeles B'Kugim Rechavim Shalom De Torah Al Taras HaKodesh. This approach to Rashi, which is accepted in many, many circles, of those who learn Rashi, Al Taras HaKodesh, Eino Kol La'as L'Matara, it does not get to the point of what Rashi is really all about. Al Pi Havanaseinu, as Mishnah Sosha Rashi, he says, according to our understanding of Rashi's Perush, there's a line missing, I skipped the line, Pshuto Shel Mikra, Al Pi Havanaseinu, as Mishnah Sosha Rashi, Pshuto Shel Mikra, the Pshat, according to our understanding of Rashi's Perush, Eino HaMatara, Ki Em HaEmtzai. Pshat was not Rashi's goal. Pshat was Rashi's means. Now what does that mean? So before we explain what that means, let's take a look at why Pshat seems to not have been able to be Rashi's goal. Why there are problems with the first approach to say that Rashi will only ever quote a Medrash when it's needed by the Pshat. Take a look at this example. This example from Parshas Vayera, where the Malachim are talking to Avraham Avinu, and the Malachim say to Avram, Vayomer Elav, Ayeh Sarah Yishtecha. The Malachim say to Avram, where is Sarah, your wife? Vayomer Hine Va'ohel. And Avram says, Sarah is in the tent. Rashi comments, Hine Va'ohel. Rashi's in the tent. Sarah's in the tent. Tznuahi. Sarah is a modest woman. Sarah is a tznua. Now this medrash is very important, because it teaches us about tznius, teaches us about modesty, teaches us about who Sarah Imenu was. But what was wrong with the Pshat? What was Rashi coming to resolve to say Sarah was a tznua? Rashi was asked a question. Was asked a question, where is Sarah? Avram gave an answer, she's in the tent. It doesn't seem to be anything wrong with that. If Rashi only ever, truly only ever quotes a Medrash when it's needed to explain Pshat, we're at a loss as to how to explain why Rashi quotes this Medrash. And if this proof is not convincing, because the reality is that it's not convincing. We only have a few minutes left, so I don't have time to share with you how Nechama Leibowitz would respond to this question. But if this proof is not convincing, how about this one? And this is not my own proof. Rabbi Mordechai Cohen, was a teacher of Tanakh in Stern College and in the Revel Graduate School. So he points out this example, which in his opinion is an inconclusive proof that although he doesn't quote Rav Kupperman, but what we presented as Rav Kupperman's approach needs to really be the way to understand Rashi's derech. The following Gemara Maseches Shabbos, which we already saw alluded to. The Gemara begins with a machlokas about whether a sword, a cheref, is considered a tachshit on Shabbos. If somebody goes out, carries a sword, is that a violation of hotza'ah, or is it a tachshit? It's something that's normally worn on something's on a person's body, and therefore it would not be a violation of hotza'ah. Rabbi Eliezer is of the opinion that it's a tachshit, and therefore it would not be a violation of hotza'ah. And the Gemara says, picking up here on the third line, my time with Rabbi Eliezer, the Amar tachshitin heimla. Why does Rabbi Eliezer consider a sword to be a tachshit, and therefore not a violation of hotza'ah on Shabbos? Rabbi Eliezer answers, "Dechsiv chagorchar b'cha al yerech gibor hotzcha v'hadarecha." Because the pasuk says, a strong man wears a sword. The pasuk already defined it as a tachshit, something that a person wears. Chagorchar b'cha al yerech gibor, something that you wear. Amar le Rav Kahana lemarbere de Rav Huna. Rav Kahana says, "Hay b'divrei Torah k'siv. A sword doesn't mean a sword. A sword means the sword of Torah, Milchamta Shel Torah. You have no raya from this pasuk that the sword is a tachshit, because this is not talking about a sword, it's talking about Divrei Torah." So Amar Lei, Ein Mikra Yotze Midei Pshuto. So he responded, you're right, the pasuk is talking about Divrei Torah on one level of interpretation, but there's a pshat level of interpretation in which a sword means a sword. It means nothing else than a sword. So I do have proof from the pasuk that a sword is something that's worn on a person's body. The pshat of chagor char b'chol yerech gibor means you wear a sword. The drash, the midrashic understanding, the additional level of interpretation is that it's b'divrei Torah k'siv, not a literal sword. Now let me ask you, and this time you can answer, not like the last question. If you were Rashi, and you were writing this pasuk, Chagor Char B'chol Yerech Gibor, is a pasuk, we're going to see it in a second, and you're Rashi writing a perush on the Torah, how are you interpreting the pasuk? Are you going to say it's a sword, or are you going to say it's the metaphorical sword about Divrei Torah? Bishus Rebbe, Bishus Rashi Cholam. How would you interpret this pasuk?
A real sword.
A real sword. Why would you say a real sword? Of course you'd say a real sword, because Rashi is, that's a problem. I don't know if I know how to solve that problem. Oh, here we go. Okay. You would say a real sword because Rashi, as we saw, is about Pshita Shel Mikra. Rashi only ever quotes a Medrash when the Pshat demands that Medrash to be quoted. Here the Gemara says very clearly that the Pshat can stand on its own. The Gemara says very clearly there is a Midrashic level of interpretation that Krub Edivrei Torah Ksiv, but the Pshat means a sword. So if you were Rashi, and you know that here this pasuk can sustain the pshat without the medrash, there's no way you'd ever quote the medrash as the parish of the pasuk. But that's what Rashi does. Right? Rashi. Sefer Tehillim. Chagor char b'chol yerech gibor hotzcha v'hadarecha. Rashi explains, lehilachim milchamta shel Torah v'hu hotzcha v'hu hadarecha. And that's surprising. Because if it's really true that Rashi only ever quotes a medrash when that medrash is needed in order to explain the pshat, that Rashi will only quote a medrash if there's some question, something that was bothering him that he could not get around, and he needed that medrash to explain the pshat, it's very hard to understand why Rashi quoted this medrash. Because here the pshat stands on its own. The Gemara already acknowledged, the Gemara already said, that here the pshat is self-sufficient. And this idea... this Rashi, so we pointed out before that Rabbi Cohen refers to this Rashi, and this Rashi seems to line up in the Rabbi Kupperman camp, not the Nachama Leibowitz camp. It seems to be that this Rashi is a very strong indication that there's something else that was driving Rashi other than Pshat. Rashi was not always only quoting Midrashim when they were needed to explain the Pshat. There might have been something else that was motivating Rashi. Rabbi Cohen formulates this in a book of his on Rashi. He quotes a scholar named Sarah Kamin, who's also in this camp, in Rabbi Kupperman's way of seeing Rashi. And he argues, of course, maybe we'll just leave it. We can see when it goes up on the board. It doesn't get cut off at the top. It's good enough. He writes, according to Kamin, Rashi distinguished between Pshat and Drash, but never intended to limit himself to the formal exegetical category. His goals were, one, to preserve the integrity of the Pshat of Scripture, the Pshat of Tanakh, and accordingly, two, to select Midrashic interpretations that meet methodological criteria that are analogous, but not identical to the criteria of Pshat exegesis, to the criteria of Parshanut. In other words, what this school of thought advances, the way that they see Rashi, is that Pshat was a major player for Rashi, but the way, as Rabbi Cooperman formulated it, not as a matara, but as an emtsa'i. Not that Rashi was quoting Midrashim to explain Pshat, but Rashi wanted to teach Midrashim. There were Midrashim that Rashi wanted to teach us. Rashi wanted to give us a way of understanding the psukim al pi medrash. But he chose specifically only to quote those Midrashim which can be read in with the Pshat. Not that there's no other way to read the Pshat without the Medrash. Not that the Pshat could not have been read on the level of Pshuto Shemikra without the Medrash. But Rashi will only quote Midrashim. There are some Midrashim which are very hard to reconcile with the text of the Psukim. And there are Midrashim which fit in more readily, more easily, with the flow, with the context, with the syntax of the Psukim. Rashi wants to teach Medrash, not Pshat. But he does so using only Midrashim, which fit in with the Pshat. Question is, though, if this second approach is correct, question is, why would Rashi do such a thing, right? If we learn like the first approach, Nechama Leibowitz's approach, the way we saw the Mizrahi developed at the beginning, that Rashi only ever quotes a Medrash in order to resolve the Pshat, so we understand very simply why Rashi quoted the Midrashim that he quoted. Rashi wanted to explain Pshuto Shel Mikra, which is one level of interpretation. Rashi thought that Medrash is critical in order to explain the Pshat, because the Pshat has no way of being explained without the Medrash. So that's why Rashi quoted those Midrashim. But if Rashi's goal really was to teach Medrash the whole time, not to teach Pshat, then why was it so important to Rashi to teach only those Midrashim which could fit in with the Pshat? He wasn't out to explain Pshat, he was out to explain Medrash. And Chazal gave us all different types of Midrashim. So why did Rashi discriminate? Why did Rashi selectively choose only those Midrashim which fit the Pshat? So I'll share with you three possible answers to this question, and that's probably going to lead us to the finish line. Two answers suggested by Rabbi Cooperman, and then a final answer, which is a little bit of a speculative approach, but it gives us what to think about, suggested by Rabbi Cohen. Rabbi Cooperman offers two answers to this question. Rabbi Cooperman suggests that within Medrash itself, there are different levels of Midrashim. Midrashim, which can be seen as more closely connected to Torah Shebichtav than others, are a higher level than Medrash. Rebbe often explains to us, based on the Prima Gadim, the Psicha Kolelis, that Torah Shebichtav, in some senses, has a higher halakhic status than Torah Shebaal Peh. Rabbi Cooperman develops that idea in an elaborate way, which is beyond the time that we have to develop right now. But he suggests that Torah Shebichtav, on some levels, both in a halachic sense and in his opinion also in a midrashic sense, is somewhat of a higher stature than that which is purely Torah Shebaal Peh. So he says maybe Rashi wanted to quote those midrashim for that reason. Inherently in those midrashim there was some higher status, something significant about midrashim which can fit Torah Shebichtav. Second suggestion Rabbi Cooperman offers is he very cleverly points out that although Rashi stands for Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki, it can also stand for Rabban Shel Yisrael. That Rashi, Reish Shin Yud, Rabban Shel Yisrael, Rashi's our Rebbe. Rashi, if one reads Perush Rashi al Torah, one learns the Chumash with Rashi, one has learned the essential curriculum of what it means to be a Jew according to our Masorah. To understand Torah Shebichtav and how to read Torah Shebichtav according to Chazal and the basics of Divrei Chazal and Torah Shebaal Peh, the basics of Halacha, the basics of Medrash, the basic ideas of Musar even that you find within Rashi of Tefillah and Chesed, we saw before Tznua Haisa, modesty. Rashi gave us a curriculum. Rashi gave us a set of the way in which a person can understand our Masorah's understanding, pure, authentic Torah thought. And if one learns Chumash with Rashi, he has that. And Rabbi Kupperman suggests that's really what Rashi was trying to accomplish. Rashi was giving us Chazal's interpretation of the Psukim. He wanted to create people who were able to think in that way, who were able to have the vocabulary. One who has the vocabulary of Chumash Rashi has the vocabulary of a Ben Torah. He has the vocabulary of at least an amateur, aspiring Talmud Chacham. He knows how to speak in the language of a Beis Medrash. So Rabbi Kupperman suggests, why then was Pshat so important? Pshat was important for memory. It's easier to remember those midrashim. He suggests maybe it was that Rashi said, if you read the Chumash with the midrashim that can be read as interpretations, they fit in with the Psukim, it's one thing. It's all Ole Bekana Echad. You don't have separate disciplines going on in your mind. You're able to have one set thing in front of you, and that's easier to remember. He suggests maybe that's why Rashi stuck to Pshat, even though what his goal was to teach us the Mesorah of Klal Yisrael, to teach us Medrash. We'll conclude with food for thought, which is one final suggestion. This is the suggestion that Rabbi Cohen advances. Rabbi Cohen advances it based on historical considerations of what was going on in Rashi's time period, in the broader world where Rashi lived, and he suggests that this might impact the conversation and contribute to how we might answer this question, and that is Rashi lived in a very difficult time in Jewish history. Right? We know Rashi lived through the Crusades. He lived during the Crusades. He did not live through all of them. But Rashi lived in a time where Christianity was developing and very forcefully threatening Judaism. And there were threats of Christian thought on Jews, that there was threat of Jews converting to Christianity, or threat of Jews weakening in their Mesorah because of the rising ideas of Christianity. One interesting thing that Rabbi Cohen observed that happened specifically during Rashi's time period is apparently, he reports, based on historical evidence, that there was a change in the way that Christians incorrectly interpreted their understanding of the Torah in Rashi's time period than they had done previously. Apparently, historically, it had always been that the Christians interpreted the Torah in a very unliteral sense, in a way of seeing the Torah as referring allegorically to other things, but it wasn't meant to be read literally. And that began to change in Rashi's time period. In Rashi's time period, you began to find people who were interpreting the Torah in its literal sense according to Christian belief and according to Christian interpretation. They were showing how the allegories of the Christian interpretation can be read in with the literal sense, with the more basic, the more what we would call the pshat of the Torah. And Rabbi Cohen suggests that this was a concern to the Talmidei Chacham of the time period. This was a rising threat in the Jewish world, because until now, you know, Christianity had been on the rise, but it wasn't such a theological threat to Judaism for the simple reason that it seemed very unconvincing. The Torah said one thing, and the Christians said, well, A doesn't mean B. A doesn't mean A, it means B. X doesn't mean X, it means Y. So that wasn't a very convincing argument. Nobody was going to buy that. It seemed the whole belief seemed to be unfounded. But then in Rashi's time period, they began to demonstrate how, according to them, they would say, no, A actually does mean A, B does mean B, and the ways that we interpret the Torah can be read in with the literal understanding, with the text. And Rashi, perhaps, was concerned about that. Rashi was concerned that people would begin to buy in to that way of thinking, and people would leave Judaism because of it. And in response, because of that, Rashi needed to provide the Jewish people of his era, of his age, with a way of defending their emunah, and with a way of responding to that. They needed to be able to articulate for themselves how our belief not only, of course, also is tied to the text, not only, of course, also emerges from the text of the Torah, but does so in an even stronger way, in an even better way than the Christian one does. And they would be able to defend for themselves, to be able to stand strongly for themselves to support their own emunah. And perhaps that's what turned Rashi to Pshat. Rashi really wanted to teach Medrash the whole time. Rashi wanted to teach Divrei Chazal. He wanted us to understand the Torah according to Chazal. The reason it was so important to do so in a Pshat sense was because that was what was needed for his people. For his people who were becoming enamored, perhaps, with the idea that what's closer to the Pshat is more true, and what the Pshat seems to say is the correct emunah, So Rashi needed to show how our belief also emerges from the Pshat and how it also ties to the Pshat. There is one question that needs to be dealt with this approach. I know we're out of time in just a minute. But that is, if one would adopt this approach, which is speculative, it's not certainly not proven. The historical facts are the historical facts, but we don't know where does Rashi say that this is what Rashi was doing. But one question we would need to deal with if we thought about this approach is, well, if Rashi is giving us the Midrashim which fit Pshat in order to convince people that those Midrashim which fit Pshat, so they're somewhat, they give us a better sense, a better grounding of our Emuna, of our faith. The question is, but we know we have all types of Midrashim. We have Midrashim, as Rashi himself says, which fit the Pshat, and Midrashim which don't fit the Pshat. And we believe, of course, in all the Midrashim. So what was Rashi doing, giving us only the Midrashim that fit the Pshat, and saying, well, these Midrashim are the ones that really convey our Emunah, and then there are other Midrashim. But any intelligent person would know, well, there are other Midrashim too, and we believe in all of them. So you can't tell me that the ones that just fit the Pshat are the ones that are going to convince anybody. So perhaps, and this is my own two cents to add to this approach, perhaps the answer can be based on an analogy to a comment of the Ibn Ezra. We're not going to have time to read this inside because we're already out of time, so I'll say it quickly outside. The Ibn Ezra, as we saw before, wrote a Perush according to the Pshat. He did not write a Perush according to the Medrash. The Ibn Ezra said that there is a Pshat level of interpretation and then the Medrash is something else. In his Hakdama to the Torah, the Ibn Ezra says very emphatically, he goes through the different four or five suggestions as to what Medrash is, what Chazal were intending in the Midrashim, but he says, but when I interpret, when I translate the words of the Torah, I'm doing so according to the Pshat. The Ibn Ezra says, with the exception of one type of Medrash, and that is the Toros of Mishpatim uvechukim. He says, Medrash Halacha. He says, when it comes to Medrash Halacha, he says, Medrash Halacha is the Pshat. Chazal told us that ayin tachas ayin doesn't mean an eye for an eye, it means money. So that's the Pshat. Chazal told us, pre Eitz Hadda doesn't mean a nice fruit, it means an esrog. So that's the pshat. When it comes to Medrash Halacha, the Ibn Ezra says, there, the Medrash becomes the pshat. However, and with this we'll almost really conclude, the Ibn Ezra says that there are exceptions to that rule. There are some Midrashay Halacha, which the Ibn Ezra says explicitly, are not the pshat. In what way are they not the pshat? Ibn Ezra says, and I wish we had time to read through it, but you have all the source sheets are the sources that you have on the slides. I was afraid people wouldn't be able to see the slides from the back. So you can look afterwards. Ibn Ezra, in certain places, takes halachos, which do not seem at all to fit the pshat. And Ibn Ezra says, those halachos are not the pshat, they're asnachta. Chazal sometimes, every once in a while, told us about a halacha, even a halacha that Ibn Ezra's view is d'oraisa. We're familiar with asnachta on a drabbanon level. The Ibn Ezra says, even on a D'oraisa level, there are certain dinim which are known through Masorah, that are known through a Kabbalah, and they are certainly the halacha, but the pasuk that Chazal learned that halacha from are not necessarily actually the interpretation of the pasuk. They were meant as an asnachta. There are certain midrashe halacha which are not the pshat. They're too far. The Ibn Ezra says there's just no way to read them into the pasuk, so of course they're the halacha. But they're an asmachta. They're not the way to... Chazal never intended it as the read of the pasuk. What we have over here, and I'm speaking quickly only because in the interest of time, what we have over here in the Ibn Ezra is, within the world of Medrash Halacha, two different types of Medrash Halacha. Some Midrashay Halacha which are the pshat, and some Midrashay Halacha which are true but not the pshat. They're true, but they're an asmachta. They're Torah Shebal Peh, but they're not Torah Shebal Sef. Perhaps Rashi felt the same way about Medrash Agada. Ibn Ezra didn't say this, but perhaps Rashi felt something similar about Medrash Agada. There are certain Midrashim which are, it could be what the words of the Pesukim mean, it could be what Torah Shebichsav means, and here Chazal are explaining Torah Shebichsav. And then there are other Midrashim where Chazal are not explaining Torah Shebichsav, Chazal are teaching us important Divrei Chazal, they're teaching us Musrei Haskil, they're teaching us Mesorahs, they're teaching us how to live life. But they're not interpreting the Pesukim of Torah Shebichsav. And perhaps if Rashi adopted a similar stance as what the Ibn Ezra took on Medrash Halacha, Rashi carried over to Medrash Agada, that perhaps for Rashi, the Midrashim which fit the Pesukim, the Midrashim which fit the text, are in a sense a higher level of Midrashim. Not to the exclusion of other types of Midrashim, but in a sense that what are the Midrashim which are meant as Perushim of the Torah, those Midrashim which can be read in with the Torah. Midrashim which are more extraneous, Midrashim which are more in the realm of Asmachta, are critically important as Medrash, But perhaps they weren't meant as a perush of the psukim, just as for the Ibn Ezra, certain midrashei halacha were critical in the fact that these are the halacha. This is the halacha in the realm of Torah Shabbat Peh in Masorah. But it was not intended as the perush of the psukim. And perhaps that, if we adopted this third approach, this other Rabbi Cohen's way of interpreting Rashi, that's what Rashi wanted to give over to Klal Yisrael, something that until his time had been known but never formulated, had been latent in people's mind but never had a demand for formulation, that there are certain midrashim which really convey to us the essence of what the Torah is trying to teach, and there is a hierarchy within midrashim. I'll just conclude, and this is really the conclusion, with the question of why Rashi, the question that was on the program, right? Why did Rashi become the premier commentator? Why did Rashi, we all know, we grow up with Rashi. We learn Chumash Rashi from a young age. Everything's about Chumash Rashi. Everyone starts with Rashi. Rashi is the most important. You can't move without Rashi. How did that happen? Why, as opposed to all the Mefarshim, did Rashi become so critical? So I don't have an answer to this question there. I don't know if there is an answer to this question, but one suggestion. There's a comment to the Beis Halevi. We don't have time to read the whole thing, but the Beis Halevi develops extensively. I recommend taking a look at a very powerful comment with Beis Halevi. He writes, the Hari Kavar Yodua, the Geula Ha'asida Tiyer Rak Bezchus HaTorah Shebal Peh. This is something that Rebbe explains to us very often also, based on the Pasuk, Gam Ki Yitnu Bagayim Ata Akab Tzim Yitnu Milash HaMasnisen, that the Geula will come in the merit of Torah Shebal Peh. That all Torah learning is important, but specifically in today's day and age, we have to place a special emphasis on learning Torah Shebal Peh, because the Yetzer Hara of this time period is the Yetzer Hara of Minos, the Yetzer Hara of Apikarsis, and the way to combat that is with the Mesorah of Torah Shebal Peh. Perhaps that's why Rashi has become so critical and so indispensable, because of all the Perushim, and all the Perushim which teach us how to read the Psukim, there's only one Perush which gives us a comprehensive understanding of the Psukim, Al Pi Divrei Chazal, and that is Rashi. In subsequent years, you have the Malbim, have more elaborate Perushim, but a succinct, easy to grasp Perush that gives you the Pshat of the Psukim, or the interpretation of the Psukim, that's not the Pshat, depending on which side of the Shir you like, and but does so Al Pi Divrei Chazal, so that's Rashi. And perhaps because we are in the era of Torah Shebal Peh, and we're in an era in Torah Shebal Peh, and in the era of Torah Shebal Peh, it's important and critical to be able to learn Torah Shebal Peh with the understanding that there are different types of Midrashim, and to be able to navigate and organize the world of Medrash, which Rashi teaches us also. So perhaps that's how Rashi gained his status, because Rashi lived in that time period we are still in, and perhaps that's why Rashi became so important. So I'm out of time, but just to wrap up, hopefully this shiur has given us a little bit of an appreciation for Chumash Rashi, which we all learn anyways, and sparked some interest in thinking about these different ways of interpreting the Psukim of the Chumash. We started with noticing the Medrash and Rashi. 70% of Rashi's Perush is based on Medrash. What then was Rashi doing above and beyond the Medrash? Rashi told us it was about Yishuv HaMikra. What does Yishuv HaMikra mean? We saw three ways to understand that. Either he's explaining Pshat, as Nechama Lubowitz said, and that would lead us to a different definition of Pshat than the other Mefarshim, like Ibn Ezra, like the Ma'ari Kara had. Maybe he was teaching Medrash via Pshat, like Rav Kupperman suggested, based on the two examples that we saw that seemed to not be able to fit Nechama Lubowitz's method, like Rabbi Cohen suggested. Rabbi Kupperman's two suggestions of the significance of that, a higher level of Medrash that fits Torah Shebaksav, or for memory purposes, Rashi was Rabban Shel Yisrael. Or Rabbi Cohen's suggestion that there are different types of Medrash which have historical significance in which Rashi was operating, that Rashi needed to show the people of his generation that Medrash which can be read with Torah Shebichsav is the Medrash which gives us the basic yesodos, the basic foundation of our Emunah. And that led us to conclude Rashi's unique status. Rashi is the Perush which gives us the tools to learn the Torah according to the Torah Shebal Peh, an age of Torah Shebal Peh, which Chazal teach us that it's Bezchus Torah Shebal Peh that the Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt. Shemhei Rav Yomei.